This is a report from iraqwar.ru, an analytical center created recently by a group of journalists and military experts from Russia. March 28th, 2003, Moscow. According to the latest intercepted radio communications, the command of the coalition group forces near Karabela requested at least 12 more hours to get ready to storm the town. This delay is due to the much heavier losses sustained by the coalition troops during the sandstorms than was originally believed. Just the U.S. 3rd Mechanized Infantry Division sustained more than 200 disabled combat vehicles of various types. The 101st Airborne Division reported some 70 helicopters as being disabled. Additionally, the recently delivered reinforcements require rest and time to prepare for combat. At the same time, the U.S. forces have resumed attacks near An-Nasiriyah and An-Najaf since 0630 hours and are continually increasing the intensity of these attacks. During the night and early morning of March 28th, the Iraqi positions in these areas were subjected to 8 aerial assaults by bombers and ground attack aircraft. However, so far, the coalition was unable to penetrate the Iraqi defenses. Also, during the early morning, the British units began advancing along the Fao Peninsula. Latest radio intercepts from this area show that under a continuous artillery and aerial bombardment, the Iraqis have begun to gradually withdraw their forces toward Basra. First firefights between the troops of the U.S. 82nd Airborne Division and the Iraqi forces occurred in northern Iraq in the area of Mosula. At the same time, the arrival of up to 1,500 Kurdish troops has been observed in this area. So far, it is not clear to which of the many Kurdish political movements these troops belong. Leaders of the largest Kurdish Workers' Party categorically denied participation of their troops. They believe that these may be units of one of the local tribes not controlled by the central authorities of the Kurdish autonomy and ready to fight with anyone for money. According to verified information, during the last 48 hours of the Iraqi counterattacks, the coalition forces sustained the following losses: up to 30 killed, over 110 wounded, and 20 missing in action, up to 30 combat vehicles lost or disabled, including at least 8 tanks and 2 self-propelled artillery systems, 2 helicopters and 2 unmanned aerial vehicles were lost in combat. Iraqi losses are around 300 killed, up to 800 wounded, 200 captured, and up to 100 combat vehicles, 25 of which were tanks. Most of the Iraqi losses were sustained due to the artillery fire and aerial bombardment that resumed by the evening of March 27. First conclusions can be drawn from the war. The first week of the war surprised a number of military analysts and experts. The war in Iraq uncovered a range of problems previously left without a serious discussion and disproved several resilient myths. The first myth is about the precision-guided weapons as the determining factor in modern warfare. Weapons that allow to achieve strategic superiority without direct contact with the enemy. On the one hand, we have the fact that during the past 13 years, the wars were won by the United States with a minimum losses, and in essence, primarily through the use of aviation. At the same time, however, the U.S. military command was stubborn in ignoring that the decisive factor in all these was not the military defeat of the resisting armies, but political isolation coupled with strong diplomatic pressure on the enemy's political leadership. It was the creation of international coalitions against Iraq in 1991, against Yugoslavia in 1999, and against Afghanistan in 2001 that ensured the military successes. The American command preferred not to notice the obvious military failures during expeditions to Grenada, Libya, and Somalia, discounting them as local operations not deserving much attention. Today, we can see that in itself, massed use of strategic and tactical precision-guided weapons did not provide the U.S. with a strategic advantage. Despite the mass use of the most sophisticated weapons, the Americans have so far failed to disrupt Iraqi command and control infrastructure, communication networks, top Iraqi military and political leadership, Iraqi air defenses. At the same time, the U.S. precision-guided weapons arsenal has been reduced by about 25%. The only significant advantage of the precision-guided weapons is the capability to avoid massive casualties among civilians in densely populated areas. What we have is an obvious discrepancy between the ability to locate and attack a target with precision-guided weapons and the power of this weapon, which is not sufficient to reliably destroy a protected target. On the other hand, precision-guided munitions demonstrated their superiority over the conventional munitions on the battlefield. The ability to attack targets at long ranges with the first shot is the deciding factor in the American superiority in land battles. The second myth disproved by this war is the myth propagated by the proponents of the high-tech war, who believe in the superiority of the most modern weapons and inability of older generation weapons to counteract the latest systems. Today, the technological gap between the Iraqi weapons and those of the coalition has reached 25 to 30 years, which corresponds to two generations in weapons design. The primary Iraqi weapons correspond to the level of the early 1970s. Since that time, the Americans, on the other hand, have launched at least two major rearmament efforts, the 1975 through 83 program and the 1990 through 97 program. Moreover, currently the U.S. is in the middle of another major modification and rearmament program that will continue for the next 5 years. Despite of this obvious gap, Iraqi resistance has already been publicly qualified by the U.S. as fierce and resilient. Analysts believe that the correlation of losses is entirely acceptable to the Iraqis, and they, the analysts, do not see any strategic coalition advantage in this war. Once again, this proves that success in modern warfare is achieved not so much through technological superiority, but primarily through training, competent command, and resilience of the troops. Under such conditions, even relatively old weapons can inflict heavy losses on a technologically superior enemy. Two enormous mistakes made by the U.S. command during the planning stages of this war resulted in the obvious strategic failure. The U.S. has underestimated the enemy. Despite the unique ability to conduct reconnaissance against the Iraqi military infrastructure through a wide network of agents implanted with the international teams of weapons inspectors, despite unlimited air dominance of the U.S. military command, has failed to adequately evaluate combat readiness of the Iraqi army and its technical capabilities. The U.S. has failed to correctly assess the social and political situation in Iraq and the world in general. These failures led to entirely inadequate military and political decisions. The coalition force was clearly insufficient for such a large-scale operation. The number of deployed troops was at least 40% short of the required levels. This is the reason why today, after 9 days of war, the U.S. is forced to resort to emergency redeployment of more than 100,000 troops from the U.S. territory and from Europe. This, in essence, is the same number of troops already fighting in Iraq. The buildup and distribution of the coalition forces has been conducted with gross neglect of all basic rules of combat. All troops were massed in one small area, which led to 5 days of non-stop fighting to widen this area. The initial attack began without any significant aerial or artillery preparation, and almost immediately this resulted in reduced rate of advanced and heated positional battles. Today we can see that the U.S. advance is characterized by disorganized and impulsive actions. The troops are simply trying to find weak spots in the Iraqi defenses and break through them until they hit the next ambush or the next line of defense. Not a single goal set before the coalition forces was met on time. During the 9 days of the war, the coalition has failed to divide Iraq in half along the An-Nisiriya al-Amanahara line, to surround and destroy the Iraqi group of forces at Basra, to create an attack group between the Tigris and the Euphrates with a front toward Baghdad, and to disrupt the military and political control, to disorganize Iraqi's forces, and to destroy the main Iraqi attack forces. A whole range of problems that require their own solutions was uncovered directly on the battlefield. Thus, combat in Iraq raised serious concerns about the problem of coordination between units from different services, limited decision-making time, and the ability to detect and to engage an enemy at a great distance made friendly fire one of the most serious problems of modern warfare. For now, the coalition has no adequate solution to this problem. At one location or another, every day of this war, the coalition troops were attacking friendly forces. The second problem of the coalition is its inability to hold on to the captured territory. For the first time since the war in Vietnam, the Americans have to deal with a partisan movement and with attacks against their lines of communications. Currently, the coalition is rushing to form some sort of territorial defense units for guarding its supply lines and for maintaining order in the occupied territories. A range of technical problems with equipment has been revealed during the combat operations. Most operators of the M1A2 Abrams main battle tank agree that the tank was inadequate for performing the set combat tasks. The primary problem is the extremely low reliability of the tank's engine and its transmission in desert conditions. Heat from the sun, hot sand, and the constantly present hot dust in the air nearly nullified the advantages offered by the turret-mounted thermal sights. Visibility range of these sights did not exceed 300 meters during movement in convoy and reached up to 700 to 800 meters during stops. Only during cold nights did the visibility range reach 1,000 to 1,500 meters. Additionally, a large number of thermal sights and other electronics simply broke down. The tiny crystalline sand particles caused electrical power surges and disabled electronic equipment. This was the reason for the decision by the coalition command to stop movement of troops at night when a contact with the enemy was deemed likely. The main strong side of the coalition forces was the wide availability of modern reconnaissance and communication systems that allowed them to detect the enemy at long ranges and to quickly suppress the enemy with well-coordinated actions of different types of available forces. In general, the U.S. soldiers showed sufficiently high combat resilience. Even in the extremely difficult weather conditions, the troops maintained control structure and adequately interpreted the situation. Combat spirit remained high. The majority of troops remained confident in their abilities, while maintaining belief in the superiority of their weapons and maintaining reasonable confidence in the way the war is being fought. It should be noted, however, that the way the war is being fought did create a certain sense of disappointment in most of the troops, meaning or feeling that they've been lied to and are openly talking about the stupidity of the high command and its gross miscalculations. Quote, "Those star-covered Pentagon idiots promised us a victory march and flowers on the armor. What we got instead were those damned fanatics fighting for every dune and sand squeaking in your ass," said one of the wounded recuperating at a hospital in Ramestein. Nevertheless, despite the sandstorms, the terrain favors the coalition actions by allowing it to employ their entire arsenal of weapons at the greatest possible range, which makes it difficult for the Iraqis to conduct combat operations outside of populated areas. Overestimating the abilities of its airborne forces was a weak side of the coalition. Plans for a wide-scale use of helicopters as an independent force did not materialize. All attempts by the U.S. command to organize aerial and ground operations through exclusive use of airborne forces have failed. Because of these failures, by the end of the fourth day of the war, all airborne units were distributed across the coalition units and used by the attacking forces for reconnaissance, fire support, and for contacting the enemy. The main burden of combat was carried by the heavy, mechanized infantry and tank units. Another serious drawback in the coalition planning was the exceptionally weak protection in the rear of the advancing forces. This resulted in constant interruptions in fuel supply. Tank units sometimes spent up to 6 hours standing still with empty fuel tanks, in essence being targets for the Iraqis. Throughout the war, delivery of food, ammunition, and fuel remains a headache for the U.S. commanders. Among the U.S. soldiers, there has been a wide-scale discontent with the quality of the new combat rations. Servicemen are openly calling these rations shitty. Many soldiers just take the biscuits and the sweets and discard the rest of the ration. Commanders of the combat units are demanding from the coalition command to immediately provide the troops with hot food and to review the entire contents of the combat ration. Among the strong sides of the Iraqi troops are their excellent knowledge of the terrain, high quality of defensive engineering work, their ability to conceal their main attack forces, and their resilience and determination in defense. The Iraqis have shown good organization in their command and communication structures, as well as decisive and well-planned strategy. Among the drawbacks of the Iraqi forces is the bureaucratic inflexibility of their command, when all decisions are being made only at the highest levels. Their top commanders also tend to stick to standard maneuvers, and there's insufficient coordination among the different types of forces. At the same time, commanders of the Iraqi Special Operations Forces are making good use of the available troops and weapons to conduct operations behind the front lines of the enemy. They use concealment, show cunning, and imaginations. And that concludes the Russian Military Intelligence Report on the war in Iraq. This is Walter Buntcake, reporting for Radical Radio, March 30th, 2003.